This is Nicholas Webb, author of What Customers Hate. Drive fast and scalable growth by eliminating the things that drive business away. And you're listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, where each week I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book, and which has been named by Forbes and LinkedIn, amongst others, as one of the top marketing podcasts. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. And since I get to read every book featured on the show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or any other resource I know of for whatever challenge you're facing, send me a LinkedIn connection invite with a message that you're a listener, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. My name again is Douglas Burdett. All right, let's get on with the show. Today, we welcome back Nicholas Webb to talk about his new book, What Customers Hate: Drive Fast and Scalable Growth by Eliminating the Things That Drive Business Away, published by HarperCollins. Nicholas J. Webb is an award-winning inventor with over 40 U.S. patents, a keynote speaker, and best-selling author. As a keynote speaker, he has traveled the world speaking on future trends, personal growth, and innovation. And his best-selling books include What Customers Crave, How to Create Relevant and Memorable Experiences at Every Touchpoint, and The Innovation Mandate, The Growth Secrets of the Best Organizations in the World, both of which have been featured on the Marketing Book Podcast. And he currently serves as the CEO of LeaderLogic. And, interesting fact, he is recently the host and executive producer of an award-winning documentary, The Healthcare Cure. Nick, congratulations on What Customers Hate, and welcome back to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Yay, it's good to be back. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. And of course, this means that you are now a member of the very exclusive club called the Marketing Book Podcast Three Timers Club.
Does this include any cash of any kind?
Well,
what can I expect?
The current members of the club, who there aren't many of them, but they kind of add, there's a lot of secrecy involved.
Right.
Like Skull and Bones at Yale University. So,
right.
But let me just tell you, you know, things are going to start happening for you. I mean, I know you're a prolific author. You've won lots of awards, a really big and very popular keynote speaker, on and on. But if you're like me, Nick, there's probably a never-ending quest to impress your kids and your wife. I know you've been married a long time. Am I right?
Yeah, I'm exhausted from it.
I know, and I'm never going to get there. And for some reason, we just keep doing this. But let me just tell you one little thing that I think is going to make them realize that stuff is starting to happen. What you do: get all four kids in the car, and your beautiful wife, and drive to the Taco Bell at Cave Creek, Arizona, where you live. And yes, you know, in addition to reading your book, I did serious research to find out that there is, in fact, a Taco Bell at Cave Creek, Arizona.
I had no idea.
In the Phoenix area. Yeah, sure. Act like you don't know it's there. Okay. So then what you're going to do is you're going to pull up to the drive-thru. Never go in a Taco Bell, Nick. Just pull up and don't tell them your name because they're not going to know who you are, but just tell them you're a member of the Marketing Book Podcast Three Timers Club and watch what happens. You know, things like that are going to start happening. You'll see what happens. And like if you suddenly get a free upgrade to first class on a plane, although you probably always fly first class, or let's say you get a free cocktail at the Admiral's Club or whatever it is, they're not going to say it, but it's because you're a member of the Marketing Book Podcast Three Timers Club. So,
you know what? I'm going to test this out. I'm going to videotape me going to Taco Bell today and seeing how those credentials really play it. I'll send you the video later.
Okay, sure. Yeah. I mean, some of the other members may not want you to blow their cover, but it's great. No, I appreciate it. And man, do you write great books. I love these books, and I'm not the only one. Obviously, these are bestsellers. And I have this theory, part of it, one of the many reasons why you write these terrific books. And when I say terrific, I mean, do you realize how much in your book I'm stealing?
Well, that's the greatest compliment, right?
Well, with full attribution too. I have no original ideas, but there's some things in here that I just love, and I've already shared with some other people. Oh, I guess I shouldn't, because I know the book hasn't come out quite yet, but when this publishes, the book will be out. So I should also mention that you were a very good sport last year during the lockdown, and you came on as a guest on Authors in Quarantine Getting Cocktails, and it was a very
interesting. That was awesome. Yeah, that was really fun.
Yeah, and that's when you first told me about your documentary. So can you tell the listeners about this award-winning documentary you've done?
Yeah, well, you know, just like you said, most of my life I'm still trying, although I've been married for 30 years, I'm still trying to impress my wife. And, you know, I have a 15-year-old still at home. And when you have a 15-year-old daughter at home, you know, it's hard because it's hard to maintain any sense of self-esteem.
Oh, yeah, I know. Yeah,
right. But, you know, I have no idea what started me on this. I met an amazing guy by the name of Dr. Power. He's a based in Dublin, Ireland, when I was traveling to Dublin doing a keynote presentation there on the future of healthcare. Something was really amazing when I met Ray, and I just really hit it off. He's an incredible guy, and we decided that there was an opportunity to really change the conversation about what's really wrong with healthcare. So, you know, I endeavored something I'd never done before, and that was to host and to write and produce a documentary film. And it was an incredible journey. I don't necessarily recommend it, but it was amazing. I think already, the impact it's having has been incredible. I think we just released it, to be available at no cost because really we wanted it to have impact. This was never a money-making endeavor. I think as of, just from a few weeks ago, we're now up to we're getting close to 20,000 views on YouTube. It is a full documentary film. It's free to watch. And I think it's a beautiful story.
Yes, and I'm going to include a link to it on this episode's website page at Marketing Book Podcast. So congratulations on that. That's very exciting. I'm impressed, so I don't know, you know.
Well, that's, I'm halfway there.
Yeah, there you go. But the other thing I was going to mention earlier is it's a great book, in part because you're also this keynote speaker. And I have not had a bad book by a keynote speaker, and I'm convinced it's because of the comedy rule, not because it's full of jokes, although there were a few things that I laughed at in the book, but it's like the comedians who work on their jokes for years. And when you see like a Netflix special, they've been working on that for 15 years.
Right,
and the same thing, a lot of the, every book written by someone who really is you could just do keynote speaking, but you do so many other things. And you've given this talk so many times in either workshops or on the big stage, and you have a sense of pacing and timing. And the other thing is that when I see a book that's less than 200 pages, it generally means the author has suffered twice as hard to make it short and knows what they're talking about. So it's
no kidding.
Yeah. So I appreciate the fact that you've suffered here. So, you know what else I should also mention is, interesting to me and so many other folks. You're the first cousin of James Webb, former Secretary of the Navy and the Virginia senator and author and Vietnam veteran, was awarded the Navy Cross and Purple Heart and so forth. Very interesting. So there seems to be quite the author family you come from.
Yeah, no, he's written some amazing novels, really great guy. And I appreciate that.
Let me just read from a couple of places at the beginning of the book, and this may be just a little bit longer than I normally do, but I can't resist. I just love the way you set this up. So from the preface, you write, "For over four decades, I've been using my expertise to help organizations improve their customer experience, CX. During much of this time, my work within the CX ecosystem was characterized by a dutiful adherence to the conventional wisdom of customer experience best practice. Like every other professional, I genuinely believed that you could use surveys, promoter scores, and other one-size-fits-all approaches to understand what customers loved. Having learned what they wanted, you'd then sell it to them. The process seemed very logical and straightforward. In fact, my best-selling book on customer experience, What Customers Crave, was the epitome of that approach. It's undeniably true that you must give your customers what they crave. That will never change. That's your ultimate goal. If you fail to do that, your business will die. But after years of working in the trenches, shoulder to shoulder with organizational decision makers, I realized that finding out what customers loved was only half the battle. In today's hyper-competitive and fast-paced marketplace, your customers are very sensitive to what they hate. about your brand, company, or service. These feelings of hate, that's just the word I use, it's short and simple, can have just as much influence on their buying decisions as what they love. Whether you're selling to consumers or business to business, perfection in the marketplace does not exist. When making buying decisions, customers are faced with an array of imperfect choices. They look around and say, the first choice is too expensive. The second choice isn't exactly what I want. The third choice can't be delivered quickly. The fourth choice makes me assemble the product, but I need to buy one of them. So which choice do I hate the least? No company, brand, or service enjoys 100% love. There must always be some degree of hate in the mix. Hate is a source of friction, and if there's too much friction, the process of moving products and services, regardless of their high quality, into the hands of consumers will grind to a halt. In my busy consulting practice, I've learned that uncovering what your customers hate about your brand, company, or service is just as important as what they love. Yet, I've seen many well-intended executives spend millions of dollars on training and customer insight programs that have had zero effect on improving their customers' experiences. Too many such organizations are living in the past. In a time of massive and continuous disruption, they're trying to optimize obsolete systems, policies, and training programs. What they really need to do is press the reset button and look at the world with fresh eyes. While writing this book, I saw that some organizations were reducing the hate of friction, and in doing so, were crushing the competition. And then I want to go to another part of the introduction, page XVI, for those listeners in Rome. In these pages, you'll learn the benefits of shifting from a singular focus of making your customers happy to include eliminating what your customers hate. This is not a play on words or a riddle. The overwhelming majority of organizations are polishing the brass on the deck of the Titanic while their customer experience ship is sinking. The data shows that most organizations deploy on fractional customer experience solutions rather than using a triage approach to first fix their gaping abdominal wounds. You can tell this author produced a documentary about healthcare. Right. And then one other part. You're right. This book, this is page 18 of the introduction. The book will dive into a thorny subject that many business owners try to avoid, the direct connection between employee happiness and customer happiness. The real secret and equally important fact is that the reverse is true. There's a cause and effect link between employee misery and customer hate. There's no way your customers are going to be happy and feel good about their interactions with your business if your employees are projecting negative energy.
Yeah.
And the last part I wanted to read, and I promise, is the last part. It's from the introduction. You write, since the dawn of civilization, when people first traded trinkets for fur pelts, merchants have tried to figure out what made their customers happy and therefore willing to buy from them. If they somehow learned the secrets of customer satisfaction, sellers then endeavored to deliver the solutions. This process continued for thousands of years, in most cases carried out by simply talking to the customer and asking what they wanted. In recent times, and especially in the digital era, sellers have tried to uncover this information scientifically using a complex array of tools, including data collection, surveys, promoter scores, focus groups, and more. And then you write, despite the expense and effort, so much of this has been in vain. Why, Nicholas Webb, why has that been in vain?
Well, thank you for reading that. Those are good excerpts. And I'll tell you that maybe I should have called this book Stop the Insanity.
I think Susan Powder already took that.
Yeah, right. That's true. Look, it is amazing how much money. We are oftentimes going into clients to help them out. Just recently, we're involved in a client that spent $7 million U.S. dollars trying to find out what their customers thought about them through promoter scores and surveys. We took a look at these 64 three-ring binders, and they were completely useless. The problem is that, you know, we have created this McDonaldization of customer and human experience, and there was some really exciting discoveries in this book. The one big discovery is, don't try to be perfect. Don't try to identify what your customers crave or necessarily hate in the first instance. The main thing you want to start with is always be the best choice. That doesn't mean that you're going to be a five-star rated business, but you always need to be the best choice. You're not going to be the best choice through surveys and through these lame approaches to getting insights. You waste money. In fact, most organizations spend the preponderance of their budget on marketing, marketing, marketing. Their focus, their budgets, their DNA is focused on client or customer acquisition, which really only represents about 25% of revenue. Mm-hmm. What they should be doing is taking a balanced adult approach towards looking at the other 75%, which includes customer retention, includes customer promotion, and the avoidance of deflection. I think one really good example, and it almost says it all, if you go to your local mall today, you will see that in many ways it looks like Armageddon, right? There are stores and plywood, shuttering stores that have been around for a long time. But one store that's come to malls today is the Amazon store. But of course, everybody would want to go to that store because Amazon sells everything. So the store must be the size of 10 Walmarts. But actually, it's not. It's one of the smallest stores in the mall. And the name of the store is not five stars. It's called Amazon Four Stars. The merchandising for the store is done by the hyper-influential community of people who buy the stuff. In fact, they take it to another level and they have digital signs, little tiny digital signs about the size of a business card over each product that shows you real-time reviews and real-time star ratings of the product. If it goes below four stars, they throw it out of the store. The point is that these products were always the best choice. And they started by being the best choice by eliminating the things that people hated. And that's what the best companies do. You know, it's a different discussion. I just recently, literally last Thursday, encouraged a customer experience team at a major hospital system to do something really brave, which of course they refused to do. And that was, are you willing to ask your patients what they hate? Oh yeah, we're not allowed. I'm sure that that's not allowed in our branding and we can't ask that. Mm-hmm. Right. And so they don't even know, they're not even allowed to ask the H word of their customers. And so all of the stuff they're trying to do to be popular and to make their patients happy is just not going to happen. You have to understand what people really hate. And it's a whole different set of methods and tools. And as you alluded to, is really the biggest problem today is that most organizations have only adopted about 90% of the people that reach out to us, and we get calls every day, are reaching out because they're in serious trouble. I rarely get a phone call of saying, you know what, Nick, it just seems like the right thing to do a better job of delivering experiences, right?
Right, right. Interesting. Yes, and that's where you talk about triage, another medical term. And what I want to ask you about in a minute is about, you talk about being on a customer experience hazmat team. Yeah, so that's right. a perfect setup. Now, that Amazon store, you didn't mention that in the book, I don't believe. Is that right?
I don't think so.
Yeah. So my point in asking that is to the listener, that's a Marketing Book Podcast extra, okay? You're getting even more than what's in the book, so you're welcome.
That's right.
Yeah. See, Nicholas Webb, he's already over-delivering. I had to laugh. There's one part in the book where you just say, you know, why does customer hate matter so much? But I want to know what your reaction, what is it you say to somebody, and I can imagine there's maybe somebody's listening to this right now, or more likely, somebody who works with someone who's listening to this. And you say, a typical business owner might say this. This is from page 4. This book is called What Customers Hate. I don't understand. My customers are my customers because they love the products and services I provide. If they truly hated my company or my products, they would not be my customers. We live in a highly competitive marketplace, and every consumer has many choices. Therefore, anyone who is my customer must also love what we sell. If they do not love what we sell, then they are not my customer. That's why it's impossible to talk about what customers hate, especially my customers.
Yeah.
What does Nicholas Webb do next?
Well, so there's two problems with that theory, right? Number one is the assumption is that the baseline level of customer expectation is stable. In other words, the things that customers want from you are always the same. The problem is we live in a dynamic marketplace where entrepreneurs and innovative companies are constantly improving the solution, they're eliminating friction, they're becoming a better choice. So if everything stayed the same, that answer might have some validity to it, but it doesn't. The baseline level, the very minimum that people expect from you and your product, is constantly rising. Therefore, your customer experience strategy and programs need to be a dynamic, rising experience so that you're constantly improving the way in which you engage customers. The other problem is that for every customer that calls you and tells you that they hate you, they represent about 360 people who simply left quietly. So, yeah, that theory doesn't work in a dynamic marketplace where people leave. And not only that, what about deflection? One of the things we talk about is digital deflection. Mm-hmm. You know, the beginning, the first touch point of a customer or a client is search. They're gonna look for you. About 90% of people begin their search for a product or service digitally. If they begin that search and they see adverse social ratings, those deflections can call. We were able to catalog a client that lost $83 million as a result of deflection. Deflections happen, but you don't know who leaves you. So it's hard. You have to do a lot of things to try to figure that out. Most organizations are losing business every single day because of the social ratings, or just personal ratings, our private ratings on influential networks like Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and the like. So yeah, it's no time to be bad. And also the C-19 economy, the COVID economy, changed everything. People are demanding a lot less friction. They press a few thumb movements and their groceries magically appeared at their front door. Virtually everything they got through Amazon and other instantaneous digital solutions. Today, customers want friction freedom. They want relevancy. They want cost transparency. They want customization. And most importantly today, they want humanity. They want the human experience back. This idea that, organizations have been displaced by, take a look at Toys R Us. You know, Toys R Us didn't get destroyed by Amazon, they got destroyed by Toys R Us, right? The experience for most people wasn't good. I'm glad to see that there's a renaissance there, and I'm very hopeful for Toys R Us. But the point I'm making is it wasn't a digital disruption for most of these organizations. It was an experiential disruption.
Yes. And when you mention how most people will leave versus complaining, it brings to mind the book by our mutual acquaintance, Jay Baer, called Hug Your Haters.
Yeah, right.
And in it, he actually fielded research thinking, oh, it's all about speed. And it was like, no, that's not what they want necessarily. They want to be listened to. Yeah. But he explained that maybe only 2 or 4% of your customers are ever going to complain. Right. And that they're actually providing you information that we used to hire research companies to find out for us. And all the others that are leaving are very much empowered to tell a lot more people about their bad experience than they could have in the past, before the digital era. So I want you to unpack this one concept from page 5 just to make sure people understand. And you write that the number one law of customer experience is your customers are always settling for second best. I started to touch on it in one of the excerpts, but I think that's a helpful touchstone for people.
Yeah, right. Well, it's hard for us, in our neo-narcissistic cloud to believe that we're second best. But, the truth of the matter is, again, it's a dynamic marketplace. Nobody's perfect. But the point is that they're settling for the best choice. And that's okay to be the best choice, right? Because you also have the complexity of serving a range of personas. So by providing great experiences and services to one persona that's really concerned about quality, you're probably upsetting the thrifty persona that's more concerned about cost. So you're always not as good as you could be. But the point is that the best organizations that I have been able to uncover are organizations that really have figured out how to always be the best choice.
And I just had to laugh at page 9 where you write, again, back to the person that's sitting there probably with their arms crossed, saying, all right, who is this web guy? Some people will say, you're being overdramatic. Customers aren't that sensitive to every little thing. They want a product, so they go to the store and buy it. Or they click on the website. They go through the process and they get what they want. No drama. Again, I guess that for me just brought to mind the people that aren't really thinking about their own experience when they are buying from someone or getting a bad customer experience. And frankly, you got to stop writing these books because this makes me the worst customer. I have such unbelievable expectations. Well, and that's not – but it's like I do want to help. I do want to help. In your book, you have these 5 touch points, and I was wondering if we could walk through those. And this is really important not just for customer experience, but to think about the sales process for each one of these touch points – and also the different types of marketing content that could be available or be made available to make for a better customer experience. So can we walk through some of the touch points? Okay, so the first one is the pre-touches.
Yep.
If you could explain what the pre-touches are.
Right. So there is a trajectory of 5 touch points of how people engage us. And unfortunately, some organizations do not analyze or map customer journeys, which is a colossal mistake. Right. On the other end of the spectrum, there was a large German automotive company that we worked with that had something like 6,300 touch points in their journey map.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, you needed, so there was one guy in the basement who I guess kept track of this of this journey. So it was non-actionable, of course. So I developed this 5 touch point to make it actionable, whether you're a muffler shop or a multinational corporation, this is the customer's journey. So according to Google, customers experience what we call micro mobile moments. For the most part, we research and engage virtually everything initially through a connected device. And this is the point where we're going to decide, what car we buy, software solution we bring for our company, what muffler we're going to buy, whatever.
Or maybe anything. Even still trying to figure out what our problem actually is.
Right. Hey, there you go. Right. They're researching what is my problem. So, and if you look at the map and you can Google the Google's micro mobile moment chart, it really kind of shows you, where do I go? What should I do? How much is it? So there's a variety of things that we look at in this pre-touch moment. I call it a pre-touch moment because right now, as we speak, every company listening to this great podcast has people coming to their website and leaving. And they're leaving because of 3 reasons. Well, there's really 3 things you have to do in the pre-touch moment. Number one is you have to show up. So when people are searching, and this is a marketing dynamic, you have to have SEM and you have to have SEO and you have to, in some cases, pay for paid search, but you have to be there if you want for people to begin their journey with you.
Right. And SEM would be search engine marketing and SEO is search engine optimization.
Right. Yeah. So in other words, getting, being there under key search terms. But when they find you, it's so funny. If you can say in rough numbers, 90% of websites are digitally suspended brochures.
Yes.
And if you look at them, they're using us language, we have this and we're the best. And that is a real mistake in customer experience because at the end of the day, the best digital properties are very, very keyword specific landing pages. So if I'm searching for shoulder surgery and I go and I type in shoulder surgery and there is a header in Google that says shoulder surgery, and I click on it and I go to a hospital's homepage, I'm leaving because I don't know where the shoulder surgery is, right? So it has to be, you have to be found and you have to be there. You have to be relevant and then you have to be valuable. Mm-hmm. So the best organizations that win at this, when you search soldier shoulder surgery, you land at the shoulder surgery landing page.
Mm-hmm.
And it says, shoulders, the 10 things that everybody needs to know before surgery. And it's a free downloadable ebook. It's a check mark, things to avoid. It is a value dispenser.
Mm-hmm.
So organizations that want to drive growth, that want to avoid deflection, that want to do a great job in client acquisition, they've got to do those things. They have to be there, they have to be relevant, and they have to be valuable. Your vertical landing pages are value dispensers. That's the reason they exist. There should be no other reason for them whatsoever.
Amen. And let me just add to that with a couple of quotes from page 21, 23. You write, if you're looking to lead your market and customer experience, you need to be readily accessible to your customers. That means you have to be extremely thoughtful about search engine marketing, search engine optimization, and omni-channel marketing. Customers need to find you quickly and easily, and they hate it when they can't.
Right.
This may not seem like a customer experience issue, but it is. Finding you or your company is friction, and customers dislike friction. If you're having this problem, then add another hate point to your total. And hate point is one of the great words from this. And then there's another one on page 23. You write, you're talking about the problem with so many websites, and the header here is no value dispensing.
Right.
That's not an exhortation. You're explaining the problem. You write, right, in simple terms, your digital property is nothing more than a value dispenser. Your website should be structured in such a way that it is delivering real and meaningful value to your site visitor. The overwhelming majority of organizations essentially suspend a brochure on the internet that they call a website. So, amen, brother.
Yeah.
Let's go on to...
let me just say there is one more caveat to that too, and that is deflection, digital deflection. Now they're searching for shoulder surgery and they find XYZ, orthopedic clinic, and it has 2 stars, right? So The other thing you have to do, and the reason that architecting beautiful experiences that eliminate hate, is that you need to have good influential social ratings in order to avoid the deflection. And this is so important. So many people lose out because they're not applying an integrated customer experience strategy, and people get mad and they post it. They're 10 times more likely, in one study, some go much higher than that, to post a negative review than a positive review. So in that pre-touch moment, don't have bad reviews.
Yes. However, it sounds like the place where I had both my shoulders done, which is has 2 stars, it's called Discount Shoulder Surgery.
Perfect.
Not true. I did have the shoulder operations, and I, in fact, I got called up by the Yankees. It was a wrong number. All right, enough comedy jokes. Let's go on to touch point number 2, which is called the first touches. Okay,
right.
And you write though that the first touch point is too often riddled with customer hate points. I was getting the impression the first touches, which touch point number 2, is that the hate point magnet?
Yeah. I'll tell you, like for an example, just last weekend, my wife and I went to a restaurant, and there was a line. It was a popular restaurant, and I go to the hostess, and the hostess said, do you have reservations? And I said, yeah, no, I'm sorry, I don't. She laughed. And her response was like, really? And I that was really bad, right? I mean, I was like, oh.
She laughed at you?
Yes. Okay. I mean, it was really contemptuous, right?
Nick, I want you to go back to that restaurant now that you're a member of the Marketing Book Podcast Three Timers Club.
Kind of flex a little bit.
Oh, they're waiting for you. Yeah.
Right. But, look, as our mother and father told us as young lads, first impressions last a lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
And so does the negativity in bad first impressions. So there is a much higher weight of first impressions. So if you have a good first impression with a customer in the first touch points, they are a lot more forgiving later on if stuff goes bad.
Mm-hmm.
And it also creates a psychological trajectory to build upon. So that first touch could be the way in which you engage a client in a B2B sales consultation. It could be the way in which you do a product demo. If it's a retail establishment or a restaurant, it's the way the restaurant smells. It's the way it looks. It's the way it feels. We are multisensory beings. So if we're in retail settings, we are leveraging millions and millions of bits of data every second to decide our net total perception of that experience. So it can be the temperature of a restaurant. It can be the smell of a restaurant. It can be how clean the front window is. It can be the facial expressions on the person at the hostess stand. All of these things create a net totality of the first experience, and they're not incidental, because the revenue opportunities and the scalable growth opportunities of architecting these experiences in a thoughtful way are incredible. My consulting firm did some work with one of the largest restaurant chains in the world. One of the things that we found was that the biggest things that people hated about the restaurant was the people that worked at the front counter. And so they tried training them over and over again. But because the culture was so bad, they never were able to fix it. So they replaced them with kiosks. Right.
When I read this in the book, I think I died a little bit inside.
Right. I know. It's that bad.
Oh, so let's go to the next one, what you call the core touch. So explain, this is touch point number three, the core touch. So we talked about the first touch. What's the core touch?
So familiarity breeds contempt. Once we get customers and we get them as part of we're doing the day in and day out of business with them, then we become less thoughtful about what those various engagements look like. And so the core touch point, touch journey point is really about what is it like to do business with you? And that can be it could be several touch points. We do a lot of work with automotive dealerships. You know, the first, their websites are amazing. They have inventory, they have real-time inventory, they have payment calculators, all the stuff that people want. And then they come in, and we've taught them to not be the cheesy salespeople. So they go through our ethical sales training program. And so they learn how to be real humans instead of salespeople. And then they buy the car. And then all of a sudden, now they go to service, and service treats them like second-class citizens, right? Mm-hmm. Or they go to parts and they have a really bad experience. Or they go to finance and they have a really bad experience. So we have to, we have to realize that this is a continuum that can't be broken. If any part of these five touch points are bad, you lose. And that's really what the core touch point's all about.
That's funny. I bought cars for my kids and so forth, but I drive a 19-year-old car, and I'm convinced it's because I don't want to have to go back to the dealership. I know just what you're talking about there. Can you tell the story about the hotel, the luxury hotel that you have as a client, helping them understand that what they thought was the problem of price was not really the problem?
Right. And we've seen this, we do a lot in hospitality, and it is a big issue. In fact, hospitality has hijacked the COVID pandemic to use it as an excuse not to clean rooms. Like right now, if you go to a hotel, chances are they're telling you because of COVID, we're not going to clean your room. And I'm like, well, wouldn't you want to clean it more? I don't quite get that.
Like the airlines, right?
Yeah, but we had clients, and one example is they come and check in, and they decided to add a cleaning fee. And we have, I can't remember which one of my clients I referenced in the book, but it's a real big problem in hospitality. So you check in, and the room is $280 or whatever the number is. And then they say, great, well, thanks for coming. There's a $17 parking fee. We have a $30 resort fee. I can't remember what their actual numbers are.
No, that's right. $30 resort charge. I had the book here.
Okay.
Yeah. Cleaning fee, $50. It's like, $50. Oh, man.
Right.
Death by 1,000 paper cuts.
Right. And so they concluded, when they started seeing bookings falling off and seeing their Yelp ratings drop to the floor, they concluded that pricing was the problem. We're in a shared economy where everybody knows everything. When you go, the thing that blows my mind about a lot of the hospitality people is, first of all, don't call something a resort that's not a resort, and certainly don't charge people a resort fee. Mm-hmm. The second thing is, cleaning fees are your cost of doing business. Why would you even articulate those words to tell a guest that you paid $280 to come here and we're charging you $30 for a resort fee whatever the number was for cleaning fee,
yeah.
and then parking. I mean, it's just, and I'm, you know, we sit there and do mystery observation. We do what we call safaris. And in the safaris, we sit there and watch this go by. Every single person that went there hated them after they left the counter. Literally every single person. Yet they're spending millions of dollars. This particular client, one of the largest hospitality chains in the world, they're spending millions of dollars on so-called customer insights. Get out of your corner office and go look what you're doing. I mean, come on, right?
And I love that term. That's one of the ones I like so much. I hate safari. You just mentioned it there, but it's got a whole chapter about you got to go on a hate safari. And right. I mean, you actually have to look for it. Stop waiting for your customers to bring this to your attention because they might not.
Yeah. No, it was a cashectomy that they were performing.
Yes, that's another great one, a cashectomy. If you hire a consultant, you get a cashectomy.
Right.
And they're basically telling you something that you could have found out on your own.
Absolutely.
So that was a good example of where it was just all kinds of hate points being racked up. Let me just go to page 49 here. And this is on touch point 4, the last touches. I want to quote, "There are some cynical companies that believe once they've gotten your money, the game's over. The rest of it, particularly order fulfillment, is just a routine that should be accomplished with as little effort as possible. Companies that seek to minimize hate points and build love points across the entire customer journey see it quite differently. They know that there are two powerful reasons why providing an excellent customer experience at every touch point, including after the customer has paid, is beneficial for the company and its bottom line." Can you talk about that? This touch point 4, the last touches.
Yeah. So, you know, there are these sort of shocking last touches. Most organizations that are failing have shocking last touches. And most organizations that are scaling with unbelievable profitable growth also have shocking last touches.
In a good way.
In a good way.
Yeah.
So the shocking last touch is, you know, let's take it from a medical practice. The shocking last touch is a receptionist checking out a patient and talking loudly about when they're going to pay their bill. That's incredibly shocking. Another example, and what all of our healthcare clients do, their shocking last touch is to pick up the phone call within a few hours after the doctor's visit to find out how they're, if they were able to get their prescription, if they had any additional questions. The ratings, the social ratings are so much driven, and the hates and loves are so much driven by what we leave people with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and as a keynote speaker, one of the things I've learned is that it's what I leave them with, right? It's that last moment. It's that last message. And the chances are the 60-minute keynote was non-meat fillers up until that last touch point.
What do you mean non-meat fillers?
Well, in other words, I'm saying a whole bunch of stuff, but the thing that they're going to remember is those last few things I say.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah. And that's how experiences are, is that what can we do to surprise them? Nordstrom developed a habit and a policy, which seems subtle, but it had a big psycho impact. And that was, they walk from around the physicality of the barrier of the counter and handed the bag like a samurai's sword to the customer, right? Mm. Literally bowing with this bag. Like, what? That's awesome. I'm coming back.
Right.
I don't know why I like that. You know, they know that I'm a three-timer? They must.
It reminds me of the Apple store where they don't really seem to have any registers. They just stand there on the table by the table and
I've done research there. You know, they identified that these hidden registers were important because basically customers saw cash registers as profanity.
Mm. Yeah, interesting. So those are the last touches, and it's such an opportunity. You know, just calling to follow up is so rare.
Yeah. We know in healthcare that the impact of that is incredible. And there is one last touch, which we call the in-touch moment. And that is, you know, we take people for granted. I mean, anytime anybody does anything with me, they probably need to get a restraining order, or I'm going to not stop communicating. I mean, not to sell them stuff, just like, hey, I read a really interesting article. I appreciate the consulting work we did for your company, but I found an article really made me think of you, and I'll send them a copy of the article. Not because I'm trying to sell them, but because I want to constantly, you know, create the continuity of our experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's touch point number five, the in touch. And it occurred to me that touch point number five is where the real money is for most companies.
It is. And here's the problem. A lot of the people that are creating hate points in the in touch moment. Look, Apple, I have like in my office, I'm sitting here right now, and I'm not exaggerating. I probably have 9 Apples in here of computers, laptops, iPads, more computers.
Oh, and those are to give away to listeners of the Marketing Book Podcast. Right?
But you know, the thing is they know where I live. They know my phone number. They know my email, but they're very surgical about contacting me. It's very rare. And when I do hear from them, chances are it's shrink wrapped in some sort of value that I really care about. Meanwhile, you know, I'll buy something from a company that literally puts me into some, drip funnel, outreach program, and I hate them for it, and I'll never buy from them again. Right. So we have to be really careful. The only reason you stay in touch with a customer, the only reason is to continually support the fact that they honored you with business. Mm-hmm. If you have something to sell them and it's a genuine value and it's meaningful, it's fine to sell them to use that information to sell them. You have to be very, very, very restrained and very thoughtful about how you do that, because it's an easy way to damage what would otherwise be a great relationship.
You know, this brings to mind something from my ad days where years ago, we actually had a HVAC client when we did advertising. And at one point, I was asked to come and speak to a large regional group of HVAC company owners. And I was just explaining some of the basics of marketing. And one of the things I was explaining to them was based on a video. I went out and shot a video that showed, you know, me asking people what companies they were aware of. And, you know, there were the usual answers. But what several people said on the in the video was, wow, you know what? We just bought a new $10,000 unit just this year, but I can't remember the name of the company that did it. There were several like that. And I explained that, you know, one of the most important things you could do is keep in touch with your customers, maybe remind them to change their air filters or send them a holiday card or something like that. And one of the companies spoke up, and he was an owner of a company. He said, you know, one of the smartest things we ever did, I'm surprised he said this in front of his competitors, but when you get a new unit, they install a thermostat. And on the little thermostat, they had just engraved the name of their company and the phone number. And he said that doing that one thing made a big difference.
Yeah,
because people would then remember, and it would be right at the point where they would realize it wasn't working, or it would be a renter or a new owner of a home. But that was just a way of them for them to keep in touch. So,
well, it's a great way to generate revenue. We worked with a large spa manufacturer. And, they sold, you know, the $3,500 hot bubbling water in your backyard type jacuzzi, right? And it wasn't a jacuzzi brand, it was a spa. And so they decided to implement a program where 3 days after the spa was delivered, now this is in California, and they were selling something like 800 spas a month. So what they did 3 days after the spa was delivered or installed in the home, they had a UPS package show up, which was their spa maintenance kit. And it was a bucket, and inside the bucket was a thermometer and a test kit and a spa brush and spa scents and a few other things. But it was beautifully packaged. It looked like this amazing Easter basket, for the lack of a better description. From that, they instantly saw that 60% of their new business was coming from referrals, right? So they significantly reduced customer acquisition cost and increased top end revenues almost instantly from that silly basket that cost them $47. And you know what they did? They increased the cost of their spa $50 so that they could take that budget and put it into the thing that they gave the customer. Mm-hmm. No difference in sales. It didn't reduce sales, that additional $50, but it increased their, they had 60% of their new business came from that silly box. And I can give you thousands of examples of that. And it's really neat to be in touch with them by delivering that last value.
Yes, such a differentiator. Let's go on. I've got to ask you perhaps a controversial question, Mr. Webb.
Bring it.
One of the biggest ones. Explain what you mean when you write that companies should stop focusing only on what you think customers want. That's chapter 7 title. Stop focusing only on what you think customers want. Wait a minute. I thought we're supposed to keep in touch with our customers. What are you talking about?
Well, listen, it's a really, really big problem. The survey industrial complex, this hundreds of millions of dollars are spent on trying to figure out what customers want. Meanwhile, these people are waiting. They're being overcharged. They're being treated horribly. I mean, let's not go there just yet. Right? Let's start with looking at, and that's what's so, I had so much fun doing this book. I've written, I don't know how many books, maybe 8 or 9 books, right? And this has been the best book that I've ever been involved in because it was a religious experience. it really was. I mean, maybe it's because I like to complain more than I like to, but you know, for a guy who is a customer experience Nazi, I guess. This was a great book to write. We got to stop that. Steve Jobs spent no time trying to decide what you wanted. He understood the marketscape and what was possible, and he gave you. I never knew that I needed a connection to all information in the world in a multifunctional device that fits in my pocket. I never knew that I needed that, but Steve Jobs knew that we needed that, right? So the great companies are not counting on erroneous and small data signals from horrible, erroneous promoter score data and survey data. It's just such a colossal waste of money. What we have to begin with is to do this dosimetrically. We start by eliminating the stuff that customers hate about us, right? And we do that across all of our customer personas. Most companies have 4 to 6 personas. We do it across all 5 touch points, and that's all it takes to become the best choice. And being the best choice means that you are the market leader. So this idea, I get nobody calling me saying, I want to find out what my customers want. They want to find out how to make them stop hating me. But unfortunately, by that time, yeah, they're already in trouble.
Yeah.
And again, I talk about, and I know we're running close on time here, but one of the things that was a really big discovery, maybe the most interesting discovery of this book, is that there is no way that you can do any of this stuff unless you address enterprise happiness. And I know that sounds sort of squishy, but I'll tell you, that's the key. That's why In-N-Out Burger rules the hamburger universe. It's why I could go on and on, right? The best organizations that are attracting the best people, that have the highest degree of productivity, the highest returns on human capital, the highest significant, as much as 60, 70% better returns on strategic initiatives. Everything that we want in our enterprise kingdom comes to fruition when we start with the fundamental of a happy workforce. That's what's required to get customers not to hate us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you write, after researching hundreds of books on customer experience, it's amazing to me that more experts aren't suggesting that the foundation of customer experience success is enterprise happiness. Can you say more about what you mean by enterprise happiness? That's not just employees, right?
Yeah, I remember getting some pushback from my editor when I said, I started that time by saying, why isn't everybody talking about this? Mm-hmm. Would you really want to say that? Enterprise happiness is really simple. Like, first of all, we are entering right now. So this is kind of what to do in 2022. We are entering into the next pandemic. And the next pandemic is not viral. It's experiential. Mm-hmm. In other words, we have a talent drought already. There's roughly 11 million jobs and 9 million people willing to take them. But it's getting worse really quickly. And so that will continue over the next 24 to 36 months. We are in a talent drought. It's said that there are talented people and there are unemployed people, but there are no talented unemployed people.
Yes, so and I just heard on the news that in the U.S. there's like 10 million open jobs.
Right, right. Yeah, well, and the other thing is, if you have the right talent, the people that run the best organizations in the world, they can go anywhere at any time. And mm-hmm. they're not choosing, like you and I at our age, at least I was taught by my dad to work really hard, go to college, and trade your time for cash, right? But the new workforce, especially after C-19 and sitting in their zen-like state at home watching the pandemic go by, they've changed their philosophical outlook on their life, right? And what most employees today, and this isn't a Gen Z or a millennial thing at all. This is across the generational spectrum. They want to be involved in a mission that matters. They want to believe in the mission, and they want to believe that their contribution to the mission matters. So they want to be listened to. They want to collaborate. They want to co-create. They want a voice. They don't want to just be a zoo animal. They want to be a collaborator and an innovator and a co-creator. And the best talent want that. The other thing is that they want to be part of they want their job to be part of their own evolutionary journey. So they want to know that the work that they're doing is actually making them better. But we don't really have that discussion much in most organizations. But the best organizations that have built strategy around supporting stakeholders and supporting their happiness, those organizations are delivering the best customer experiences. They're far more productive. They have a higher degree of what we call presenteeism, which is sort of that lucid state of work. We know we get a far better return on human capital, on assets, and the organizations that have happy cultures have the highest degree of sustainable growth and profitability. So it's hard to imagine anything within our organization that we don't positively impact when we make the commitment. And so happiness is a weird word, right? Some people used to call it quality of work life, but it's deficient to describe what we're trying to do. Mm-hmm. And the way this happens in organizations is you start with an assessment. It's a three-step, it's an SOS approach.
Right.
Situation, objective, strategy, right? What is our current state of happiness and what are barriers to happiness? How are we, and even we talk about, you know, inclusion and diversity. If you want inclusion and diversity to happen in your organization, you have to start with a substrate of a happy enterprise. And again, it's not a little thing. I mean, go to a restaurant where the person hates their job and see what your experience is like. I check into a hotel where the person hates their job and see what that experience is like. Mm-hmm. You can't do it. You can't deliver. And customer experience is really, we are in the experience economy. Organizational growth and profitability and the cost of client and customer acquisition is directly correlated with the experiences we deliver. And we can't deliver those good experiences unless we address the experience of the employees. And what we call it is HX, human experience design. So I recommend to my clients, and this is what we're doing now, and it's with tremendous success, is you don't start a customer experience initiative unless you include improving the experiences for the workforce. It's not expensive. It's not hard to do. It's a different way of looking at the universe, but it's very, very doable. It's not disruptive, and it's a beautiful thing to watch go by, and I think it's fundamentally required.
That was a big takeaway for me, is that if you don't first get your own house squared away with your own employees, it seems like you're just going to hemorrhage money trying to make it better for the customers.
No doubt about it. Yeah.
Also in the book, you know, as somebody who reads and loves doing it, reads a lot of these books, you do talk about Steve Jobs and Henry Ford. And just to tie it back to stop focusing on what they think customers want, those two people, you actually skewer both of those popular misconceptions of Steve Jobs and Henry Ford. Henry Ford saying, if I'd asked people what they wanted, they would have wanted a faster horse. But that's not actually true. But also, you show how both of them understood what people hated. They both understood where the friction was to help guide them. They didn't just go and say, what do you want? You know, once in my ad days, I can remember a healthcare client, they went off and hired their own focus group moderator for some, and normally we would take care of that. And they hired this person, and she was a real amateur. And I remember in the focus group, she's saying, "Come on, you got to tell me what you think. I need to take something back to this client."
Oh.
I hope she's gone on to another line of work.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, you know, for somebody who has written, you know, a couple best-selling books on innovation, what most people don't realize, and here's the news flash: you heard it here today, is that customer experience is an innovation activity, period. You know, look at the definition of innovation. Innovation is the process of creating novel value that serves your enterprise and your customer. Mm-hmm. Well, apply that to customer experience. Customer experience is the creation of novel value that serves your enterprise and your customer. The problem is twofold. One is we get really crappy information about what we think the customer wants. The other problem is that we, even when we get good insights, which is rarely the case using the traditional survey industrial complex methodologies, we don't transmute those insights into actionable new innovations that actually fix the problem. So, you know, that's why I wrote What Customers Hate. Let's start where we are. The truth of the matter is most organizations aren't ready to start doing things that their customers crave. You have to do this by first eliminating what they hate. And oftentimes that's 90% of the problem, if not all of the problem, is just eliminating those hate points.
To that point, I want to get just a little bit controversial in our final few minutes here. I want you to explain this. I don't want you to name names here, but you say, I'm starting to see former executives from some of the worst corporations ever to exist in America who are no longer with their companies going out and teaching people how to deliver exquisite customer experience. We see failing hotel chains teaching customer experience programs and amusement parks that have lost their way teaching courses on customer experience. It's insane. And unfortunately, many leaders, executives, and well-meaning companies don't honestly know where to turn. Because there's an agenda, everything's going to be just fine. What do you mean by that? Everything is going to be just fine.
Some of the so-called top thought leaders in the area of customer experience are ex-executives with brand names. This one I won't mention, but brand names that you would associate with the iconic and emblematic name of what a bad customer experience is. And now they're in the business of, I'm hoping that those people are talking about how not to do what I did when I was an executive at X, Y, and Z company. Mm-hmm. So I think, unfortunately, the marketscape is littered with, let's be nice to the customer, consultants and trainers, when it's so much more than that. This is a complicated area. It is, in fact, an innovation activity. It requires a really high degree of sophistication and complexity to be this simple. And that's it.
Yeah. You know, I just want to mention, we don't have time to go into it, but such an actionable book, because at the end, towards the end of the book, you have a chapter that is saying, you know, those customer surveys, are the enemy. Stop doing it and explaining why. And of course, as you're explaining that in these chapters, I'm thinking, yes, I've seen these bad movies myself. They're too long, they're too intrusive, they're not getting to the right people, all that sort of thing. But what was really interesting is your patent pending model at the end of the book on how you should do this. And you take on the net promoter score, and I mean they all have benefits, but you're showing where the blind spots are, and then you've got this what's it called?
Real ratings.
Yeah, real ratings. And I think we're going to hear more and more about that in the future. And it gets into the different personas, which we didn't have time to get into. But I wanted to just ask you one last question about the book before we move on here. And that's where you say on page 127. Now, I want to ask you just to talk a little bit about a customer experience strategy. You say, I'm really surprised to see how many organizations have failed in the area of customer experience, and for that matter, have gone into bankruptcy because they never bothered to create a customer experience strategy. Isn't that interesting? They plan everything, facilities, people, money, everything. But isn't it odd that one of the biggest causes of their failure is not delivering value to their customers? Yet these organizations literally never had anything that even resembled a customer experience point.
Yeah. Hallelujah. Right. I mean, it's so interesting to me. You know, there's the old adage that failing to plan is planning to fail. Mm-hmm. Boy, that is really true when it comes to customer experience. Customer experience is a professional discipline. You know, you would never hire an accountant who hasn't had accountancy training, yet we wave our scepter over some poor victim in the company and call them the director of customer experience, right? Mm-hmm. Or we hire somebody even worse to come in that was the customer experience director for some company that was using legacy methodologies that were coined back in the 1950s. So, you know, yeah, of course we're going to fail if we don't do this right. A customer experience strategy has to really ask some tough questions, and the answers aren't easy to get to, but they're fundamentally necessary. You know, who is our customer? What is our range of personas? What does their experience really look like across those five touch points? Mm-hmm. What is their baseline level of expectation from us in terms of the experience, the product, the service? What are the things that are going wrong? How can we, you know, and on and on. How do we gain insights? How do we go beyond surveys? How do we? You've got to have a plan if you want to win at this. I would say that as we go, it's going to get a lot tougher in the next 36 months. Organizations that aren't starting with eliminating what customers hate are going to fail. Mm-hmm. And you do that with a plan. I mean, it's just that simple.
Yeah. You know, I can't help but think of the Maya Angelou quote when I read a book like this, which is, she said, "I've learned that people will forget what you said, people will forget what you did, but people will never forget how you made them feel."
100%.
Yeah. Yep. So, Nick, if readers took only one thing away from the book, what would you hope it would be?
Oh, God, I hate that because I feel like there are so many great points I unearthed.
Oh, that is the most unfair question in all of podcast land.
I would have to say that, you know, if you take nothing away from this, you should at least endeavor the process of putting together a formal strategy that really focuses on eliminating the things people hate. You need to have a strategy, and that strategy needs to have the substrate of looking at hate, because in a time of hyper competition and uber consumerization, really that's the secret to making it over the next 3 years.
Amen, brother. And yeah. You know, I was just trying to think of a way to put the pill in the treat for the dog to eat it.
Right.
And I was thinking, like, it's like I've already chatted with a couple people, and I was saying, okay, well, let's assume there's something about you they hate, but let's find out what they hate about your industry. And I find that there's less, they're like, oh, okay, yeah, that would be a good thing to find out about.
Yeah.
Things they hate.
It's interesting. I was thinking about this the other day when somebody was asking me about hate points. And you know, like, if I were to ask my wife, you know, how's everything going? She'd say, yeah, it's fine. right. But if I were to say, let me ask you a question now, forgive me for its stark nature. What do you hate about me?
Oh my gosh. Oh, when my God. I saw that headline in your book, I thought about, yeah, I could ask my wife that. And she would say, I'm going to need some time.
Right. Yeah. Right.
And a legal pad. Yeah.
Now my wife would never say this, but she may say something like, well, you know, you put your clothes, your dirty laundry on top of the hamper instead of in the hamper. And, you know, sometimes when you get up at 4 o'clock in the morning on Saturday, you know, you're kind of noisy and I'd like to sleep in. And then, oh, and by the way, right. But, you know, it's a hard thing for a company to be willing to really ask those kinds of questions, because think about how simple that would be to remember. Oh, well, I've got to put my laundry in the basket and I need to be more quiet. It's an easy fix. It doesn't cost me anything. The hardest thing was the emotional trauma of the unexpected answer that might come. But then if you look at it from a real ratings perspective, my wife might likely go on to say, hey, I love your imperfections. You're a great husband. You're a great father. You are very thoughtful. You're da 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 da. Right. So I'm doing okay. All I need to do is fix these things and we can continue to march on in this happy marriage. Right. That's really what it's like to do the hate point analysis, is that they want to do business with you. Probably, maybe the ones that you don't even have as customers today would bring you on if it wasn't for the fact that you do things that make them hate you. And so I think it does sound like a play on words, but it really and truly isn't. It's where we have to start. We have to start by doing the demolition, and then we can build the new building. This is the demolition part of customer experience.
Okay, but in the book, you talk about why customers are reluctant to express dissatisfaction directly to a company.
Absolutely. So what you have to do is you have to be willing to do many different things. One of the things that we do really successfully is what we call CX hackathons. And what we do is we, instead of getting some survey that's sterile and non-actionable, we bring together customer-facing stakeholders and we ask them what they've witnessed in terms of what customers hate, right? And it is amazing. We've never done a hackathon with any company of any size and not invented multi-million dollar solutions, literally, because they're saying, well, you do know that when we went from a 3-minute wait on the phones to a 9-minute wait, people hung up before we even got to talk to them. And then if they did call back, we begun the conversation with how mad they were.
Right.
Right. And you do know that our new Jarvik 9 now charges for shipping where they've never paid for that before, right? Right. So it's amazing how much you get in terms of understanding hate points from customer-facing stakeholders every day through a hackathon. And that process actually invents the solution. So what's the solution? How much do we lose by losing those customers and the cost of new customer acquisition versus charging them $2 for, you know, for shipping? Mm-hmm. And that's the beauty of it. Now you can, if you're, you can get those answers, but you don't get them through a survey because they won't answer them typically in a survey form. You've got to do customer interviews. You have to do safaris. You have to do, ideation sessions. There's lots of different things that are not very mechanized. And that's why most customers or most companies default at surveys. They create great graphs and charts. They're actually designed to artificially make you look better than you actually are, which most people don't realize.
You talk about leading the witness.
But right, you know, leading the witness.
But you talk about how a lot of these companies, they're getting a response rate in the single digits. Folks, right. That's a problem.
That's a problem. It's really funny. Like, I'll just give you an example. There is the largest consumer insights company in the world sent my wife a survey for her to fill out after she bought her car.
Did they know who her husband was?
Right.
That should have disqualified her right then.
Oh, no. I mean, I perused through this whole thing. And again, I won't mention the name of the company. I don't want to hurt any feelings here. And then they sent another one. And then they sent a third one. I think it said final notice. I'm like, oh, final notice. Oh, boy. I better open that and see what this is about, right?
You're in trouble now.
Yeah, it was the survey. So finally, after 3 attempts to get my wife to invest an hour of her time to provide them non-actionable insights, they finally realized that despite the fact that she just bought a luxury European car, that they knew the secret. Now, this is a fact. This is done by the largest consumer insights company on the planet. They sent her a dollar bill.
Ah.
And there's a dollar bill that you could see in the window of this envelope. Now, she just spent a fortune on a car, and they're now telling her that they're going to give her anybody that they should take whoever decides to fill that form out and take that dollar bill. They should do the opposite of whoever that nut job is in terms of the data they get. What were they thinking? And this is emblematic of the bizarre industrial complex of surveys. And it is wrong, and it's hurting so many great organizations. Look, the sad part is there's so many great companies that just want to do the right thing, and they're getting bad advice, and they're getting this is a really profitable part of customer experience is the survey business, and unfortunately, it has turned into, for the most part, in my view, a racket.
Yes, absolutely, and you make that case very clearly. Last question: are there any recent or upcoming books that you recommend or looking forward to reading or seeing come out?
Do I have to exclude my books?
No, I know there's others besides the 3 that I've mentioned. No, tell us that too.
Yeah, well, I actually have a book that'll be out in a few weeks called Heyday, and the subtitle of the book is How to Make. Yeah,
How to Make. You told me about that when we were drinking cocktails. That's right. Tell us if you have time.
So it was fun. You know, it really came from the work I was doing around employee happiness. And so it's a fun book that really talks about, you know, how to live your heyday, how to really develop systems, tools, and processes to really change your level of happiness. And, you know, this was done during the darkness of the lockdown and in some of the research we were doing regarding customer experience and culture. So yeah, it was a really, really fun book.
And you got the idea on a flight, didn't you?
Yeah, right. I was sitting next to a guy that had basically saved up for 3 years to go to Miami, Florida to sit in first class. And he spent 5 hours telling me about how he used to be cool when he was in high school.
And just so the listener knows, Nick is not talking about me.
Right. I've got other stories. Okay. But
he was going to Miami. I'm sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. And well, you know, the thing for me is I realized, isn't it sad? This guy was well into his 70s. And this going to his high school reunion in Miami was an opportunity for him to revisit a time that was, you know, decades and decades ago, back when he was happy, where he was, you know, living his, you know, he was in his heyday. And it made me wonder why people aren't able to stay in that heyday for the rest of their life. I mean, you've known people that that peak and then they decline. And so the book really is about these three states of human consciousness, what I call heyday, hate days, and haze days, and how to avoid the two that are derogatory and how to do things that really move you into you know, a mission that matters in a way that you're authoring your own evolution in a way that serves other people. So it was fun. I have also recently just picked up and read again, if you haven't ever read it, The Power of Focus by Canfield and Victor Hansen and Hewitt, which is, it's an older book, but I think for those of us who are, you know, have ADD, which many of us do, The Power of Focus is a really a great book, although it's old. I think it's still in print, and that's one that kind of just showed up my radar recently.
Oh, terrific. Well, there are an awful lot of great books from a long time ago or 10 years ago. And so just because it's new doesn't mean you have to read it. So, well, at marketingbookpodcast.com, we're going to include links to everything linkable, all the books you've mentioned and the documentary and your websites. And I'm going to include your LinkedIn profile and your Twitter profile. And the reason I'm going to do that is because I want to ask the listener a big favor. Please reach out to Nick Webb and thank him for being a guest on the Marketing Book Podcast. He spent a whole lot of time with us, and I really appreciate that. And the past guests on the Marketing Book Podcast just love it when they hear from Marketing Book Podcast listeners. And if you have a question or any kind of contact, Nick is very responsive. And I mean, come on, he seems like a nice guy. He actually will respond to you. So
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So, and if you are a listener, if you're listening on this on your smartphone and you subscribe to the Marketing Book Podcast on your favorite podcast app, all these links can be found by going to this episode right now and clicking on the show notes link. One last quote. Thank you for reading What Customers Hate. The intention of this book is to challenge the framework and beliefs of the traditional customer experience best practice. Getting out of your comfort zone and taking a fresh look at the problem requires courage and a willingness to be open to new ideas. The principles revealed on these pages are based on a lifetime of study and have been used in my own practice with significant success across multiple industries and organizations. I trust that your application of these practical solutions will serve you and your organization well. The book is What Customers Hate: Drive Fast and Scalable Growth by Eliminating the Things That Drive Business Away. The author is Nicholas Webb. Nick, thank you very much for returning once again to the Marketing Book Podcast.
It was awesome. Thanks again for having me.
And that closes the book on another episode of the Marketing Book Podcast. I hope you enjoyed it and found it helpful. If you are one of the hundreds of listeners who've left an iTunes review, please let me return your kind favor by mailing you some Marketing Book Podcast bookmarks and laptop stickers. Just send me your mailing address anywhere in the world, and I'll drop it in the mail. And remember the words of the entrepreneur, author, and motivational speaker Jim Rohn, who said, "Formal education will make you a living. Self-education will make you a fortune."